Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hey, everybody. Today's guest is singer-songwriter Ryan Cabrera from Los Angeles, California. Together, we break down the writing, recording, and inspiration behind his breakout hit single, On the Way Down, taken from his 2004 debut major label album, Take It All Away. Ryan's story is fascinating. A young singer-songwriter is plucked from the smoky bars of Dallas, Texas, and told he's a star. He's going to get taken to and put up in Los Angeles to write songs with other notable songwriters and look for a record deal. And that's precisely what happened. Along the way, he was asked who his dream producer would be. And one of the names he listed was Johnny Resnick from the Goo Goo Dolls, who was immediately interested in the idea of working together. The pair hit it off, and upon the first hour of meeting, had already written a song together. Ryan mentioned that On the Way Down moved super slowly out of the gate, but was assured by the label heads at Atlantic Records that the song was performing perfectly and not to rush things. And they were right, as the track eventually climbed all the way up to number 15 on the Billboard Hot 100. Oh, and there's a David Lee Roth connection to this song as well. Make sure you listen in to find out how.
Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast.
What's up, Ryan? How's it going?
Dude, I'm doing great, man. How about you?
Fantastic. So are you still residing in Dallas, Texas?
No. That's old school. I was raised in Dallas. I moved out when I was like 20, 21 years old.
Okay. So around the time you released On the Way Down?
No, actually. So I left Dallas and moved to, long story short, Joe Simpson, who was Jessica Simpson, Ashley Simpson's dad, saw me playing acoustic in Dallas. And I was like 3 months into college, UTD college, you know, it was like a community college, whatever. But I was 3 months in and Joe literally said, yeah, you're going to move to LA and you're going to move in with me and my family. And I'm going to make you a star, kid. Like straight out of the movie, like, I'm going to make you a star, kid. I'm like, all right, wait, so what am I doing? Literally 2 days later, I'm on a flight to Los Angeles and I moved in with the whole family and in Encino, California. Didn't even have a pair of shoes, dude. All I had was a pair of flippy floppies and just one little suitcase, and I was out. Didn't even tell my parents I was leaving.
Okay, because for some reason I thought maybe you were still a Dallas guy, because I had reached out to Jarrett Reddick from Bowling for Soup this morning, and I said, hey, you got to know Ryan, right? Because they had the song about your wife, Alexa.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah. He's like, tell him I said hello. So, known Jarrett forever, and I thought maybe there was some connection there. But
well, the connection there, I mean, there's me and Jarrett have been great friends now for a while, but like I used to open for Bowling for Soup like a couple, like back in the day when I was living in Dallas, and I was in a band, and then eventually went solo, but it's funny how like it all comes full circle, like later on, and you know, and Jarrett sang at my wedding and became a good friend. We were actually, when I was first talking to my wife, the first time we ever chatted, which is via text, somehow Bowling for Soup came up and I'm like, wait, you know Bowling for Soup? He's like, yeah, I think I'm gonna do a music video with them because they wrote a song about me. And I'm like, wait, what? So it was a wild connection between the three of us. I was like, I love that, man.
That's awesome. Well, when you released your independent debut record, Elm Street, in 2001, was that prior to Ashley's father finding you?
That was prior, yeah. So that came about by my brother. I was in a band at the time, and my brother got me recording studio time for my birthday. I'd never been in a real studio before, or just a studio at all. And he went, and he's like, he gave me the gift, whatever. And I was like, oh, heck yeah. I told the band, like, we're all going to record. And then my brother found out how much it was going to cost. So it was a little out of his budget, you know, at the time. And so I was like, I had to tell the band guys, like, sorry, my brother only has enough time for me to go in acoustic and record three songs. So when I went in and did that, the guy, the engineer that was working in the studio was like, dude, he's like, I don't really have any artists like you come through. And I love like your stuff. Like, what if I just record you for free? You keep coming in. And I was like, yeah, done. So that's how I made that Elm Street record. Just me solo acoustic. It was the first time I'd ever been on my own. And then in Dallas, like it kind of started, never like took off. Like I never got like really popular, but like, you know, there would be like 50, you know, people at my shows where originally there was five, and then it would grow to like 100 people at the shows, and then a couple hundred people. And then it was like, wait, maybe there's something cool about doing the singer songwriter solo acoustic thing.
Yeah. I wanted to ask, so what, you know, you're kind of seeing, you're building a following. Were you working it, or was just kind of maybe like a hobby or something you did on the weekends? Or were you like getting a mailing list together and trying to, you know, have an online presence or whatever there was for an online presence in 2001 or two?
Yeah. It was all mailing, all emailing lists.
Yeah.
Write your email down every single show. And I was trying to do every gig that, you know, possible. I played in every bar around town. I drove to Austin like on the weekends, played in Austin, and, you know, did the grind for like 3, 4, or 5 years of just nonstop.
I was going to say, though, that's kind of an impossible grind. And I say that because I know so many friends of mine. I know guys in established bands that try to do it in reverse, and they'll go out and pick up the acoustic guitar and try to do it. It's a lonely world out there. It really is. And, you know, all I knew was I got in a van with my band when I was young and started playing shows, and we started connecting the dots. It happened organically and very slowly, but you got thrown in the fire here. Were you scared to death going to LA? Like, what am I doing here? Did you feel worthy? Did you feel like I can do this? Or, you know, what was going through your head?
I think I was so naive and how I thought, you know, the music business worked. And, you know,
yeah,
that was, you know, kind of the beauty of being, you know, young and dumb for me at the time was I did believe, like I did, and I wasn't very good. Like I hadn't like really established like who I was yet, but I really thought like I deserved to be there. But that was just in my head. And so luckily, because of that kind of naivete, I was walking into rooms with like the presidents of record labels with flip-flops on, with an acoustic guitar, and kind of throw it in. And that to me was kind of exciting. I thought it was kind of fun how scary it was. You know, I'd walk in a room with, you know, the president of Columbia Records, and he would just go, "All right, impress me," and sit back. And I'm like, "Huh? Okay. How do I do that?" And I think, you know, I was just kind of in that mindset of like, no matter what, at some point, like I am going to make it, and no matter what it took. And so I got rejected. Every single record label told me no. They all said, "We love your look. We love your voice, you know, but we don't hear any hits. So no." And I didn't understand what that meant at the time. Cause I'm like, "What do you mean? I'm going to write hits. Like, we're good. Like, why wouldn't you want to sign me? You said you liked everything." I didn't understand that. So I went back to the drawing board and just started writing and writing and writing. And then eventually wrote True and On the Way Down and what essentially became that first record. And then those same labels started calling and be like, "Yo, you know, where?" And I'm like, "Wait, I thought you said no." And now that I know the business, you know, after being in it for 20 years, I'm like, I get what was happening then. Had I known what I know now, like gone in with that mindset, I probably could have just given up and be like, "Dude, this is going to be way too hard. Nobody wants to sign me." But luckily, being kind of naive, I just didn't care.
Right. So you get out there, and I mean, you got a bunch of people that you're working on songs with. Is it Sable or Sabelle Breer?
Oh, Sabelle. Yeah, Kurt and Sabelle.
Right. So I noticed for this track, On the Way Down, Sabelle is credited along with yourself and Curtis Frasca. Now, Curtis has worked with Avril, Third Bass, De La Soul, Queen Latifah. Sabelle's worked with Avril, OAR, and a bunch of other bands. So you were working with these songwriters. You were signed to Atlantic, but...
I wasn't signed yet.
Oh, you weren't signed yet?
No, okay. I wasn't signed. So basically how it went down was there was a publisher named Evan Lamberg at EMI who is... you know, a genius and one of my favorite people in the music business, just a great guy. He goes, "Yo, I know there's potential here. Why don't I give you some money to, you know, to live? Cause I know you know, you're going to be out in LA and you're traveling in New York, whatnot. Let me give you a deal. You'll have some money to live and you just keep writing." And, then eventually, you know, I ran into Sabelle. He introduced me to Sabelle in New York. And then we started writing, and then we, you know, kind of came up with the songs that eventually led to a deal with Atlantic.
Had you written with anybody before, or was this all new territory?
No, that was those were the first two people I ever wrote with.
Was that at all intimidating, saying, wow, you know, I'm this young kid, I've been thrust out here to L.A. Did they put you up at the Oakwoods? Is that where they had you living?
No, I live with the Simpson family. But I know all about the Oakwoods because I eventually, when I, you know, 2 years later, when I finally got, you know, a publishing deal, I got my own apartment and it was right next to the Oakwoods, which was, gotcha. We used to call a different name, but. Think we all know.
Gotcha. Well, a couple other things here, some parallel things that happened with my career. We had a record engineered by Doug McKean, who engineered
the Muffin Man.
Yeah, and I, you know, Doug's no longer with us. Yeah. I don't know if you heard.
Doug was a huge part of my album. In, you know, credit of course to Johnny Resnick, you know, being the producer of the record. But I didn't realize at that time like how much an engineer actually, you know, is technically co-producing it as well, because Doug was a huge part of a lot of the parts that actually made the record. And then so much so that when I went to make my second album, we already knew the players we wanted. And so I had Doug engineer that second record, and I ended up producing it myself. But technically, I consider that a collab between Doug McKean and myself and Johnny Resnick.
Doug, I can't say enough about him. He engineered a record for us that we did with Rob Cavallo, and he was the fastest editor I have ever seen on Pro Tools. The guy was just an absolute machine. And can we also talk about who played drums on this track? Greg Bissonette. And
yeah.
So, I mean, were you aware of his background? Because, you know, you're a little younger than me. He played with David Lee Roth. That was his big break in the 80s. He played on all those David Lee Roth hits. So what was that like working with Greg?
Dude, I didn't know much. So Resnick brought in a lot of the cats that him and Rob used on the Goo Goo Dolls records, and you know, just these A-list players like Paul Bushnell, which at the time I had no idea. I was just so happy to be making an album. I never asked what records anybody had been on. I never like looked up any credits. I just considered them like, well, you know, immediate family, because you know, we spent so much time together curating those songs, and those players are as much as producers as well. But then I didn't realize about Bissy until I went to go see my buddy and his dad, and they were playing in Ringo Starr's All-Star Band, and Greg Bissonette's playing the drums next to Ringo Starr, and we see each other backstage, and mind you, this is like 8 years later, and he literally started singing, you know, two or three of the songs. He's like, you know, which I love that, you know, 40 Kinds of Sadness started playing. I'm like, how do you remember that? Because I was such a small, you know, blip on his ultimate radar of records that he's played on. And then I saw him, I'm like, what are you doing here? He's like, I didn't realize kind of the magnitude of how, you know, incredible and all the records that he played on, and Freeze played on the record, you know, Jason Freeze. And, you know, it was, and then I eventually went and saw Green Day and saw him playing in Green Day, and who was one of my favorite bands, you know, of all time. So sure. it was my mind was blown. But I'm glad, you know, in a sense that I didn't really know at the time, because it kind of it made me just focus on what I was there for, which was making my record. As opposed to, you know, worrying about anything else at the time.
And I can see just from talking to you, you got a smile on your face. These are happy memories.
Like you're the best.
You've been in the business for over 20 years and you're not jaded. That's refreshing. I like it.
No, never.
And I got to tell you, I'm a huge John Resnick fan. I've loved Goo Goo Dolls before they were a household name. I loved them when they were touring around in the van. And I was looking for other production credits, and you know, I couldn't really find anything else that Johnny had done. So how did you get hooked up with him, and you know, how'd the label give him the green light to produce the album?
You know, that was so when I first signed with Evan Lamberg, the guy at EMI, very beginning, and he's like, you know, is there any like dream collaborations or like writers or, you know, people that you wanna put on the list? I'll go out and see if they wanna work with you. Now, I was joking at the time, but of course, I'm shooting for the stars. I said Rob Thomas and Johnny Resnick. Not thinking anything of it. You know, for me, it was kind of like a joke, like, yeah, right?
Yeah.
And then one day, just randomly, Evan calls me and he said, hey, so I talked to Johnny Resnick. I played him some of your stuff and he loved it. He wants you to come over to his house in the Hollywood Hills and just go meet him. And so I'm like, wait, what? And now, mind you, this is like a year later. Like, I'd already written most of the record. I just, you know, I thought it was a joke. Turns out, you know, I went to his house. We just played music for hours and hours and hours, listened to tons of stuff, ended up picking up a guitar. And then I remember the first thing, and I'd heard about him doing this, but I didn't, you know, really know if that was like a real thing. First thing he does, he's like, hey, grab a guitar. I grab a guitar. I start playing some chords. He's like, no. He's like, just start untuning it. And I'm like, wait, what? And I was like, wait, I know, like, yeah, because I knew like one of his songs and it was weird tuning. So he just starts having me untune all these strings. And I just start, you know, figuring out, you know, sonically, like, okay, like that kind of works, that kind of doesn't work. You know, I've done drop D before, like everybody else, but not like literally every string.
Yeah, he's like tuning to open G and stuff.
Tuning whatever, yeah. And I didn't even know what it was. And I ended up doing something. And then he did something. And next thing I know, we wrote this song called Illusions together. And I was like, what the hell just happened? I wasn't even there to write. We were just hanging, listening to music. Next thing I know, I wrote a song with Johnny Resnick, you know, one of my heroes. And it was just so much fun. And then we wrote another song together with Cara DioGuardi, and that went really well. And then at that point, we kind of developed a relationship. And I was like, dude, do you want to just keep working on this record? And he's like, dude, I'm not on tour right now. Why not? And so then we, you know, got the approval for him to produce a record, first record he ever produced. So that was new. And it was interesting because there was a lot of nights where we actually didn't get along, you know, in the beginning, because I'm young, dumb, think I know everything there is, you know, this is his first time producing, working with like, you know, a newer artist who I'm sure was really frustrating for him, because I'm like, well, this is my record here. So I think this should sound. And he's trying to give his expert advice. And so sometimes I wouldn't listen. Sometimes he didn't want to listen. And we actually had to get Evan to come fly down from New York and almost have like marriage counseling between the two of us. So
in the back of your mind, though, you have to be thinking this is the same guy that wrote Iris and Name, though. So
I
wasn't,
I knew that, but I kind of threw that out the door. Like when we agreed to work together,
that's awesome.
In my head, I'm like, this is a level playing field. Now I should have been, you know, more like that. But at the end of the day, it made me grow. It made him grow separately, I think, you know, doing something different and, you know, kind of learning from each other. I thought, and there's a tension that is actually, you could hear in the music, that if I worked with anybody else, it wouldn't have been that way. And so the tension that came from our dynamic is what created that original Take It All Away sound, you know, which has a very distinct sound that is because of what was going on between me and Resnick, you know, behind closed doors. And then after we finished the record, then I kind of got that, like, I just made a record with Johnny Resnick, you know, a genius in, you know, in our business. And then it sunk in. And then I'm like, and I probably pissed him off a lot. So who knows when the next time we're going to talk is. But, you know, the record went on, you know, to do really well. So I know we were both kind of like in our like, oh, it worked kind of thing. And so it was an incredible experience at the end of the day.
I love that story. And I love that creative tension.
I forgot to tell you the whole point of what I was talking about, like doing that tuning. When we went to go record the song later, after I wrote it, I never wrote down what I tuned those strings to. So whatever we did on that demo, I'll never play that the same. I'll never know exactly what the tuning was. So as genius as it was, you know, that he does that, and as wild as it was, I'm an idiot for never writing down what we actually tuned it to. So the original Illusions, I still to this day have no idea how to play as it is on the record.
That's awesome. Well, I love that story. Ryan, I want to jump into this song. It's 3 minutes and 32 seconds. We got an 8-bar intro with drums, electric guitars. Those are clean guitars, acoustic guitar, bass guitar, and an island kind of vibe loop playing along with the band. Tambourine, shakers. I hear some congas panned left and right. Not sure if it's a bass guitar overtone, but there's these really cool swells on each root note. What is that?
I think it's like a backwards bass. I think McKean would do a lot of like weird crap just randomly, and then I would come back to the studio and hear it and be like, the heck was that? It was dope.
I almost had to. I was on YouTube at first. I was looking at a lyric video. And then I went to the your regular video that you had made for the song.
Yep.
And I was still hearing these things. And then I went to Spotify and I was still hearing it. It almost sounded like, you know how when you got an old crappy MP3 file?
Yeah.
That's almost what it kind of sounded like, was sparkling in the background. But it's the production of it. And those swells are so cool.
Yeah. I mean, and that was all their genius ideas, because I wrote it on the acoustic guitar, And then, you know, they kind of just started doing weird stuff to it. And then it was somewhat similar to the demo, but not at all. I don't even know how to explain it properly. But yeah, there's a lot of interesting things that eventually, which are great on the record. But then when you go to play it live, we were like, it took us a while to figure out how to, because, you know, especially back then, like in 2004, I believe was our first tour where we were performing that whole record live. And I'm like, we're not playing a track, you know, we're just doing the full band thing. And so we're like, how do we recreate, you know, some of those things? Cause it was before kind of people were doing, you know, hitting a pad and then it would, you know, kind of play.
Sure.
Play to the record.
Eventually
we figured it out, but I love the bass part on that too. That kind of makes the whole riff.
I love breaking down songs like this too, because it isn't until the end of the chorus that we get the first chord change. You know, we're talking, it's about 45 seconds in this song. It's the same progression, but it's what's coming in and out. The instrumentation, the different pieces that are coming in, that you don't feel that you're in the same progression. You don't feel you're in that same world. And when it finally does move in the chorus, and we're going to get to that in a little bit, it's such a great relief when it does happen. But I love that, because as I get older, I wish I could simplify my songwriting. Sometimes I try to get too fancy. I gotta have more chord arrangements, and sometimes you just don't. Case in point, this song. We get into verse one. Same chord progression as the intro, again, and the same overall instrumentation. Gotta ask, do you remember if your lead vocal was doubled here?
I don't remember. I don't think so.
It doesn't sound like it to me. I do know that when people started doubling with Pro Tools, they'd get really, really locked and they would ghost one back, but it sounds like a single vocal.
I think we did that in the choruses.
Okay.
If I remember correctly, I remember for me thinking it was weird, you know, mind you, I'm making my first record and I don't know how, you know, albums are made, or I didn't know that that was even a thing. So when he had me singing like melodies the same, he's like, oh no, it'll be a double. I'm like, wait, what? And you don't even notice. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of people wouldn't even know that pretty much a lot of the choruses you hear on pop rock records are doubled, you know, the same exact melody, just doubled and then ducked down. So it just kind of makes it a little thicker.
Yeah, for sure. And there's so much going on in the chorus with the loop and everything that's happening that I couldn't really discern if there was a double. It makes sense because there's a lot of vocals going on there.
Sick and tired of this world, there's no more air, tripping over myself, going nowhere, waiting, suffocated, no direction, I took a dive.
Sick and tired of this world, there's no more air, tripping over myself, going nowhere, waiting, suffocating, no direction, I took a dive. And
yeah, so this one at the time was kind of, you know, for me at that time, I was kind of going through like an interesting relationship in like the religious world of like, I'm at a loss for, you know, kind of where I am, who I am. And it's like looking for something, you know, to actually, you know, to come, what's about to come, which is to, like, when I'm on my way down, is there anything that could somehow save me? And so this verse is just kind of the setup of, you're just having a tough time in your life. And, you know, there's things that nobody else really understands. And you just feel like you can't even breathe. And it's a very, very like just personal song of like, nobody else could understand. I could try to talk to somebody about it, whoever it is, whether it be girlfriend, parent, God, you know, whatever you believe in, whatever that is, like you just feel like nobody's listening kind of thing. And that's kind of the setup for what's about to come in the chorus.
Okay. And did you already have the title or any of this kicking around before you got with Sabell and Curtis to co-write it? Was there anything there, or was it on the spot? You got in a room and you maybe explained what you just explained to me about the emphasis of the song and you went from there?
Yeah, this one came, started with the riff. So we didn't start with the title or anything. It just started with, I had like a, and then the verses started to come. And then once we got the verse, that kind of led to what was going to be the title, which was On the Way Down. So yeah, we didn't have like any ideas kind of preconceived, but it was like more of a song that came about from just talking. And I think during those sessions, if I remember correctly, like I would talk and Sabell had this like, well, at the time, little tape recorder, like actual tape recorder and a notebook. And so she would just kind of take little bits of what I would say, you know, like phrases or whatnot, and just talking about what's going on in life and taking those bits and be like, oh, that could be kind of cool, like in a verse area. And then we'd kind of spring up about from like those little bits. Because, you know, sometimes for me, like some of the best songs are just conversational. You know, it's like I want to be able to just be chatting with you, and then you take it and you manipulate it into a way of like, I don't know, is it like sounding cool, but a little bit more songwriter-y, a little more clever than just, yeah. But it's just simplifying, you know, the idea and just being like, we're having a conversation like, oh my God, you know, I'm sick and tired of this world. Like I feel like there's no more air, you know, and then you take out like, I feel like, you know, I just, you know, or like, I feel like I've been tripping over myself every day, you know, and I'm just going nowhere. And so you take out the like, oh, tripping over myself, going nowhere. What I'm waiting for, and it's like, I feel like I'm suffocating. It's like, oh, waiting, suffocating, you know, and then the kind of chop it up from there is kind of how we were, a lot of the songs that we all wrote together, three of us, is kind of like how those came about.
And sometimes, you know, the direct way of a line or the way you speak is the obvious.
Yeah.
Sometimes the obvious isn't, you know, isn't the right answer, but sometimes it is. Yeah. Sometimes just the way that you're expressing yourself, and it's smart. She was sitting there with the tape recorder.
Yeah.
I want to get this guy in a stream of consciousness when he's not really thinking about the lyrics. He's just talking about his pain or his struggle or whatever he's going through. And the next thing you know, you got a couple cool lines out of it.
Yeah. Oh, look at, I mean, Wildflower, Tom Petty, that whole song was a stream of consciousness.
Wildflowers, you belong in a boat out at sea. You belong with your love on your arm. You belong somewhere you feel free.
Because you wonder, like, how could somebody, you know, be that brilliant? It's like, it's actually, it's simple, but sometimes even actually the simplest stuff is the hardest to get.
Right. Well, here in verse one, we get our first harmony on No Direction. And on the last line, Took a Dive is alone by itself. The band stops there. And there's a snare fill over the word and to launch chorus one.
On the way down, I saw you and you saved me from myself. And I won't forget the way you loved me. And on the way down,
on the way down, I saw you and you saved me from myself. And I won't forget the way you loved me. And on the way down, I almost fell right through, but I held on to you.
What I wanted this kind of song to be or represent was anything that, you know, could help you out in your life that, you know, and it doesn't have to be something specific for me. I wanted, especially when I was making that first album, I wanted everything to kind of be a little bit more universal and not like, here's exactly what the song means, but the general synopsis of that would be anything in your life that, you know, takes you out of a dark hole, whatever that be. For some people, it could be, it doesn't have to be a you, it could be music. You could be like, you know, when I was on my way down, you know, and I felt like jumping off the edge, I found this artist that saved me from myself. It could be, you know, a person that, you know, your loved one, a friend, your, you know, a higher power, whatever you believe in, is really just whatever that saving grace for you is who is the, you know, main character in that song.
I've waited all my life to cross this line to the only thing that's true.
Hey everybody, don't go anywhere. We got lots more with Ryan Cabrera coming right up after a few words from our sponsors.
Ready for a head-bangingly good time? Dive into the world of heavy metal with the Brutally Delicious podcast. Here, we don't just talk music. We welcome you into our heavy metal family. Join us for candid chats with legends and rising stars. We go beyond the typical interviews, exploring raw emotions and the life-altering impact of heavy metal. So whether you're a die-hard metalhead or just curious, join our family and let the head-banging begin with the Brutally Delicious podcast.
Hey, I hope you're all enjoying today's episode of Krista Makes a Podcast. It's listeners like you who keep us going strong. And the most impactful way to help us keep this show going is to head to KristaMakes.com and sign up for our supporting cast. You'll get weekly bonus episodes of The After Party, where we do fun episodes about music history, classic albums, tour stories, trivia, and everything else you can imagine. Plus, there's an enormous back catalog of these episodes, so we can keep you laughing and learning for a really long time. So yeah, for the cost of buying us a drink because you enjoy Krista Makes a Podcast, you can help us continue to create episodes with all of your favorite artists. Just head to KristaMakes.com to sign up, and from the bottom of our hearts, thanks for listening to the show. And now back to the show.
Well, we got some cool things happening here in chorus one. It's the same chord progression until the line "I almost fell right through." The progression changes there, and as I mentioned a minute ago, it just feels so good. Slightly overdriven stereo guitars join the party here in the chorus, along with the swirling ah-ah vocals. There's a lot of vocals in here, and that's why, again, it was a little difficult to discern if you had doubled the vocal here in the chorus, because there's just so much that's happening here. Those vocals, those ah vocals, are panned off left and right, kind of swirling around. Sounds like, again, computer noise or like a guitar pedal noise, kind of spacey, that's buried in the mix here, kind of swirling around. And on the word "through," the feedback, that noise that I'm talking about, is very pronounced over pan on the left speaker. Almost fell right through, but I held on to you. I gotta ask, you were credited in the liner notes. Did you play acoustic guitar on this song?
I did, yeah.
You did?
I played all the acoustics on the first out, yeah.
Awesome, awesome. Did you play any electrics on here or just the acoustics?
Just acoustics. I think I may have played some rhythm parts just to get that same feel, because especially at that time, like, you know, there's a certain feel on certain bits, but the majority of all the electrics was Greg Saran. But we started every song with just the acoustic, and then Greg would kind of work around that.
Very cool. That's fascinating to me. I always ask, because, you know, everybody works differently. You know, a lot of times someone like yourself might come in and, yeah, I build the whole song on an acoustic with a click and the whole band joins me. Other times the whole track's there and you'll come in and play acoustic. So I always like to pick people's brains. It's cool.
Yeah, with this one, we actually played all together, which I know is kind of unprecedented, you know, for a lot of records being like, you know, piece by piece. But I thought I really wanted to, and Johnny as well thought it'd be cool. Like, we actually all played at the same time. So drums, bass, electric, and acoustic. And then everything else was kind of overdubbed after.
That's awesome. Well, we get a harmony on "Saved Me From Myself" in this chorus. And that's really the only harmony that's here. Again, you got those ah-ah vocals that kind of have some harmonies happening with those.
I used to love those pads, those ah pads.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know why at the time. I think in my head, I thought it was like Beatles-y. So I'm like, oh, no. Uh-huh. Ahs, and then the harmony on the ahs and the big ahs, and then you just smush them down and kind of make that the background instead of just all, you know, the three-part harmonies. But and then you just have like a little touch of it at the end, which kind of makes it like pop out, that you don't even know, you know, that it does, but
right,
feel that it does.
Well, speaking to the end, and we're going to get there, you know, the melody kind of changes on the last chorus. And I have to ask, because the other two choruses here, the word "down," like "on the way down," that right there is really the only thing I go, "Mow, that sounds like Resnick. That sounds like just that note choice right there." Do you recall talking about that at all? The rest of the song, I mean, yeah, it could sound like Goo Goo Dolls. It could sound like a number of bands. But that particular part, I was like, wow, that really does sound like a Johnny-ism.
No, because I mean, all the melodies, everything was already done like way before we even met. But I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, him being such an influence of mine with that first record, that you'll like hear things that'd be like, oh, you know, that's a very Johnny thing at that time. Or, you know, like Rob Thomas, you know, there's certain things that you do that you don't even know that you're doing, which could have, you know, stemmed from an influence. For as far as like any like the melody stuff, there was, you know, only a few songs that, you know, I think he came in and he would be like, hey, this could actually be an even better, you know, melody, I think, than what you guys already had on the demo. And I'd be like, you know what? You're right. That is better.
Because I've heard this song hundreds of times. I hear it all the time. Still, grocery stores, you hear the tune. I never knew Johnny produced it. And I never picked that out before. But as I'm combing through this, I'm like, wow, I could hear that. And again, as you said, it could be because he's an influence. And I love stuff like that as well. After chorus one, we go into an 8-bar reintro. Same instrumentation as the top, but now there is another loop with these cool atmospheric swirling sounds and a killer guitar lick panned off right, playing a great counter melody. That lick runs through all of verse two that is right after it, albeit it's mixed lower than it is here in the reintro. The lick kind of comes back when the vocal comes in. I've been wondering why it's only me. Have you always been inside waiting to breathe? It's all right. Sunlight on my face. I wake up and I'm alive. Cause.
Yeah, so that verse is kind of the realization of whatever it is that's bringing you out of that crazy funk or whatnot. And, you know, for me at that time, it was just inside of me of like, oh my gosh, you know, you can do this or whatnot. And it's, you know, just kind of that transition period of like allowing whatever it is that can kind of save you from, you know, yourself or like your mind kind of messing with you and taking you into a place that, you know, you don't need to be in, allowing whatever it is that is saving you from yourself in and realizing that, you know, it is going to be okay and you will get out of this. And that's where, you know, like the allow, you know, like all of a sudden the sunlight hits you on your face and then all of a sudden it's like, boom, the realization, you know what? I'm alive. Like I'm back. Like I'm here. You know, I got this.
Well, there's a couple interesting things here in chorus two. The lyric is the same as chorus one, but it's the same overall instrumentation. But I swear, Ryan, that the vocals are louder here. I kept A-B-ing them.
I wouldn't be
and
surprised.
And I swear that they're up a dB or two in the mix there. And there's no harmony on Saved Me From Myself. If there is, it's nowhere near as present as it was in chorus one. Now, I know you did this record to Pro Tools, so it wasn't just copied and flown to the next chorus, copied and pasted. So do you recall hearing those nuances? It's really interesting that that harmony is just not there. And I swear those ahs are louder, but it's cool.
That, you know, it could have been... It could have been an accident because I remember like in those.
I've heard that a lot.
Yeah, because I do. And I still have somewhere like this notebook, like this thick of every page of every song of every part. And like, and ever since then, you know, I don't know if it was just the times, you know, I think what we made that record in 2002 of a checklist of like this harmony, this bit, this loop, this everything. And it was 5 million notes because it tripped me out because I've made, you know, 200 songs since and done things such a different way that I saw the notebook. I'm like, oh my gosh. Like, and there was like, you know, you have the thing on the wall and you're checking everything off of like what you've done, what you haven't done, what you have left to do, harmony parts you haven't done. Cause now it's so different. You're like, I sang the chorus once, sing the harmony once, they're going to fly it to the next chorus. But like realizing that, I'm like, we probably just missed it on the checklist because there was hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of tracks for that specific album that like, it was intense, you know. I don't know if we were that like aware, like this might be the best thing for the song to drop that. I do know like when things were raised, like the ahs, like if those were raised like a dB or half a dB, that was on purpose.
Did Doug mix the record, Doug McKean?
Yeah.
He did. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
And I know that they like to also speed up the chorus half a BPM and then go back to the verses. So if anybody, and I know just from my drummers along the way, kind of being like, dude, I'm, because they're putting in their own track. I'm like, I'm playing this track, but some reason the chorus, like I forgot. Like Johnny and Doug love to speed it up by just half. Cause he's like, dude, you won't even know. You won't even know what happens, but you're gonna feel it. Yeah. And so that would happen on all the choruses. And then I think the half a dB going up just on the volume of the ahs was a this is a bigger chorus now. It's number two. And then it probably goes up on chorus three just to be like, now this is even bigger. Because he was all about, you know, building to where like the end was just the most ultimate thing you can be.
Life goes on the way down. I saw you and you saved me from myself. And I won't forget the way you loved me. And on the way down, I almost fell right through. But I held on to you.
Well, I gotta tell you, the next three sections, it's a minute long. It's from 141 to 241 in the song. 1 minute out of a 3.5 minute song is a good chunk of time. The progression does change here for this bridge, but this whole minute, there's a lot of parts. I've broke it down by calling it a bridge with basically a breakdown and a post-bridge. I was so afraid of going under, but now the weight of the world feels like nothing. No, nothing. Again, the progression here has changed. We get backing vocals on the word I that hold out, as well as going under. Those backing vocals come, and they're pretty pronounced and pretty loud there. Then we get harmonies on but now the weight of the world feels like nothing. No, nothing. On those last two lines, the guitars, stereo guitars, get really choppy and heavy here. A very different texture that happens. And on nothing, there's this low, buried harmony panned off left that's kind of cool and haunting there. So set up these lyrics, this part.
Well, backtrack. Just the reason why it's probably a minute, minute and a half, or whatever, is because the bridge is my favorite part of a song. Especially then, like nowadays, I think people kind of get a little lazier with the bridges, but especially then, like I just loved that you could take a part and just go somewhere completely different with it, and it didn't really matter how long it was. So yeah, it's a breakdown of like there's, you know, the heavy bridge and then goes into something else, which kind of, it's almost like a little storytelling of just in the music itself. But this is also, you know, like the I was so afraid of going under, like, you know, just trying to be honest with what was happening, and it's like, you know, I really was afraid of, you know, not being able to come out of this, you know, dark hole. And then, you know, once I found whatever it was that saved me from myself, it feels like the whole weight of the world is just, you know, off my chest. My head is in a much better place. And now, you know, it's like that feeling of like, you can do anything. And that's, I think, the choppy guitars that da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And there's more harmonies because it's more of a brighter place lyrically, you know, in wherever you are in your journey of the song, it's kind of allowed for more harmonies and the and like, you know, kind of the falsetto harmonies and stuff that are coming in. It's like, it's meant to be, it's still a darker musically song, but with like happier harmonies going on there because you're in a better place.
Yeah, and I only had mentioned the length only from the standpoint of when you and I've been doing this for a minute, analyzing songs like this, and it's fascinating because it's usually not that long of time, and that, you know, normally I wouldn't really talk about, oh, this section was that long, but it struck me. Then we get into the next section here, which is what I'm calling the breakdown. We get this down, down, down. It's a backing vocal panned kind of left and right. The drums break down here to bass drum and side stick snare hits, bass guitar and acoustic guitar panned off right with a percussion loop running underneath it all.
You're all I wanted. You're all I needed now. You're all I wanted. You're all I needed.
Down, 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 you're all I wanted. Down, 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 you're all I needed now. Down, 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 you're all I wanted. You're All I Needed on Needed. You hear you exhale and breathe during that part.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget when I first got Pro Tools, I wanted all my vocals to be nice and clean and edited. And I had a producer, I'm like, what are you doing? I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, man, that the breath is what sells it. It's sexy. This guy's telling me that my breath is sexy. I'm like, what are you talking about? That was so foreign to hear that term. Yeah. And he meant it very genuinely. But I noticed that there's that breath that happens there. And then there's a two-bar stop that happens here, and there's a guitar chord panned off left that goes dun dun, and then an octave guitar panned off right that goes dun 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 that happens there before we get into what I'm calling the post bridge. But this part, this breakdown with the lyric here, what were you trying to convey?
It's just kind of like the I had no idea that, you know, when I was on the down 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 this whole time, you were all what I really needed this whole time. I just didn't know it. So it's just kind of like that, hey, I'm admitting it, you know, it's like this whole time you were right there and I just didn't even know.
And I'm calling this next part, I called it the post bridge, but it's really like a fake out here because it sounds like the chorus is going to hit you here, but it doesn't.
And then it's just that guitar riff.
Yeah, it's 16 bars of the chorus progression, but those ah-ah vocals on this first half, they're really predominant here before the vocals come in. And a new guitar lick is centered here that joins as well. And I won't forget the way you loved me, all that I wanted, all that I needed now.
Yeah, it's just the kind of appreciation of like, you know, and I won't forget what you did for me. You were what saved me for myself. So it's like the thank you.
Okay. And the next part is really perplexing to me in terms of a hit single.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Typically, you're going to want to just cookie cutter and paste the here comes the last chorus. You might change a note or something, but the first two lines here are drastically different than how you sang them in chorus one and chorus two. I love it. It's interesting, but to me, for a pop single, it's a risky move. Was it ever discussed?
You know, the more the discussions were, I never wanted to stick to what, you know, the equation of a
formulaic.
Yeah, exactly what a pop song is supposed to be. Because in that case, like that whole bridge breakdown, now a chorus with not even, you know, at that time there wasn't choruses, and it's not a guitar solo, but because it's just a simple part, but that just gives you a feeling, and then you're like, wait, where did this just come from? You know, all I wanted, all I needed now, you know, and then all the way down, I saw you save me from myself. You know, it's like, I remember them being like, that's something maybe you do that live. And then I'm like, no, because it's just like, this is the lift up. If you want, you know, the big third, like,
yeah,
shebang, like this is the show. It's like, you do that on the record. And we kind of, you know, took a couple risks with, you know, what is supposed to happen on a song like that. And then when we did it and we finally heard it, we were like, yeah, that was the right way to go.
Well, like I said, it's drastically different than the other two. For a pop song, you don't see that too much. And I really like that you stuck your neck out here. You guys took a chance. I think it paid off. That noodly guitar from the last section is even busier here in chorus three than it was in the last section. It's
all there. There's all stuff coming in here.
Yeah, last chorus, you're going to throw it all in. And I have to commend you on something, Ryan. Your recall of this time period, because I know you were enamored. Okay, you got thrown out to LA. Here you are, you're working with all these people. You're wondering what the heck's going on. You're a young kid. I'm sure you were trying to have fun while you were doing all this. You know, you're living life. And, you know, to remember all the nuances, you had never recorded like this. I don't even know if you had really recorded in Pro Tools prior to this. And here you are. You got a lot of recall because I could imagine it was overwhelming.
Yeah, well, I wanted to learn, you know. I was like, in my head, I'm like, you know, one day I want to do this, you know, for myself, you know, and it paid off because I ended up, you know, producing the second record by myself and with Doug McKean. But like the entire time, like for me, like I'm getting to work with, you know, Doug McKean, Johnny Resnick, you know, Greg Bez, all these incredible players. I was a student, but I would stick up for myself. I knew what I wanted, you know, when I wrote these songs, of the vision of it. But, you know, the entire time I'm watching everything that's going on. I'm watching what Doug's doing. I'm watching what Dan's doing, you know, who's doing the tracks. I'm watching what Greg's doing. I'm watching how everybody was doing what they were doing. Cause I just wanted to learn. So eventually, you know, I was like, you know, you never know. Maybe one day I'll get to produce a record. So, you know, so I wanted to learn the whole way.
That's awesome. Well, I love what I'm calling the outro here. So we get chorus 3, which is a full chorus, same lyrics as the other two choruses. And then we get the outro here, which I love this because we come back to that breakdown, the down, down, down part. We get that again because that's one of my favorite. I think it's one of the catchiest parts of the song. I love that you bring that back here. Those down, down, down backing vocals are left and right again. We get a new ooh, like vocal that comes in here at the end. It's pretty loud. It's pretty pronounced. Yeah. And so the lyric is down, 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 but I held on to you. Down, 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 but I held on to you. And held on to you is panned right, left, 4 times over a 12 bar fade out with drums, the loop, and guitars decaying.
Oh, on the way down, I saw you, and you saved me from myself.
The last thing you hear is that feedback, spacey noise, kind of panned off right. Do you remember some of those sounds happening? Were those just Doug dialing up weird things in the computer and running it through and going, hey, what do you think of this?
Some of them were. And I remember we, for both of the songs, we just kind of kept playing for a long time and just seeing what would happen. And I remember there was a different song that is called Exit to Exit, but like the intro came from us just playing the song out and them taking that and like reversing and doing stuff like that. So that was one of the things that would happen a lot with that record. And what, you know, him and Doug like to do is like, just keep playing, 'cause you never know what might happen. So for me, I originally ended the song after the da, 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 but then, you know, they're like, just keep playing. And we kept it going and it kind of created a vibe that was like, oh, this is kind of cool. And then it went to the side stick and the loops.
I call it the cliffhanger vibe. I always love songs that end like that because it doesn't feel like it's over.
Yeah,
makes you
exactly
feel like you want to rewind it and hear it again. And before we break, I got to ask you, you're just this kid. Your story's fascinating. Everything you did at that time, you get the mix back. Where did this song sit with the other 12 songs? Was it your favorite or did you not know it was the single? What did you think when you got the mixes back?
We knew it was the single. For me at that time, though, I thought, I didn't know how it works. I didn't know that there's a method to all the madness and whatnot.
Yeah, put out the heavier song, you do the ballad later or whatever.
I didn't know that. So I recorded this ballad called True, but like True was one of my favorite songs I'd ever written. Like just for me, like when I, you know, I remember coming up with that and then finishing it. And that was a song that took a long time to finish. But I was like, this is, you know, like for at that time, I'm like, this is the best song I've ever written. Everyone else is like, dude, On the Way Down, you know, is the lead. And I'm like, oh man, I don't know. I was like, True, like this is my favorite song I've ever written. They're like, yeah, but just trust us. And I'm like, okay. And you know, and they knew what they were doing. And I remember putting out On the Way Down and Evan Lamberg, who's a genius, is like, watch, this song is going to be a slow burner up the charts. Now, mind you, I'm young. I signed a record deal. They just came out with a new single. We're like, how's it doing? All right. It's, you know, at number 180. And I'm like, oh, wait, what? And they're like, no, this is a good thing. And then the next week, all right, it's at 170. And they're like, oh man, you know, 'cause in your head, you're like, you're coming out with a single. It's your first song ever. You know,
yeah.
It's gonna go crazy. It's gonna be top 10, whatever. Now, again, being young and dumb, didn't know how it works. And he's like, just watch the charts. And so every week, I remember going to the magazine stand on, I believe it was Laurel Canyon and Ventura. And I would go, you know, Billboard, open it up, like, 160. Next week, go to the same corner every single week, same routine, go get that magazine. And then eventually, and it kept going and going, just kept climbing, climbing. And Evan was like, watch, I've seen this a million times. Like, I've had a lot of artists. And, you know, as I didn't understand at that time, you know, I'm like, but it's going to take so long. And it did. And that's the reason why you're still hearing On the Way Down and grocery store, CVS, wherever it is, you know, 19 years later. It's not one of those songs that you just, you know, you heard for 3 years. It was this big hit and then you never hear it again. You know, I'm very, very lucky and fortunate. You know, people still hit me every day. They're like, oh, I heard All the Way Down. Blah, blah, blah. Hey, I heard All the Way Down. You know, it's one of those kind of songs. Yeah. And that was because it did that. It just had this really slow climb. And then eventually I got it and it kept going up. And then we broke top 10. And then it came, you know, just what it ended up being. And I'm like, oh, I get it now. Like, oh my gosh, this is wild. And then eventually, and then after that happened, then he was like, now we can release True. And then, you know, that was kind of like my baby of like, I wanted a song that was just acoustic guitar and the vocal and not really about the production and whatnot. And then that came out. So it was a wild ride, just kind of learning, you know, what the business was like.
Sure. Sure. Well, I got to say, man, congratulations on all your success. And I tell this to, you know, a lot of people that come on here. Most people never have a hit. Okay. I know tons of people in bands, you know, to have a hit, to have something that's still getting played 20 years later is no small feat. Congratulations. I'm stoked for you. I understand your newest single was released recently is called Prescription of You. What else you got going on you'd like to leave the listeners with before we break here, Ryan?
Yeah. Prescription of You is kind of like, it's the first single or song, you know, that we put out in a long time. And it's a very, very different vibe, but you know, at the same time, you know, I'm sure just like you guys, like whenever we make new records, new songs, like we want to keep, like, you know, growing and just challenging ourselves to, you know, get better and better. And this song is just all about the vibe, and you know, it's like more of like a, you know, fun funk dance kind of Princey kind of vibe. And then we're just still on tour. Obviously, I'm very, very lucky that we still get to just tour as much as we do. And because that's where I really, you know, feel at home is just performing and, you know, being in front of people and getting to meet people on the road. So that's kind of the plan as of now. And then that get out next year. And that was that.
Awesome, man. Well, hey, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to.
No, thank you. That was today. That was breaking down. Dude, that was way more fun than I ever could have expected. I've never done that with any song before. So it's cool to get to hear it, you know, kind of from your perspective and how, like, you know, dissecting you are and articulate with like the little part of the songs. It's crazy.
Well, thank you for saying that. I really appreciate it. I love this, man. It's been at it for almost 4 years now, and it's addicting. It's crazy because every song's different. I haven't had a song on here that I haven't liked. There's been songs that prior to this podcast I would have said, oh yeah, I don't like that song, I heard it on the radio. But once I dissect it and realize that this is someone's fingerprint, I could have never created this. Elton John couldn't have created this. Only Ryan Cabrera could have done this.
Yeah, you appreciate that's when it be-
yeah cool. Yeah,
you're making me want to go listen the song. I'm gonna go listen to songs today in a different way because of this.
Awesome, buddy. Well, thank you so much, man. All my best to you.
Yeah, Chris, same as well. I'm feeling, I need it. Your body got me on the floor. You got it, I want it. The medicine and the cure, cause you got looks to kill. What's the deal? What I gotta do to get you out of those heels? I'm telling you, no, dosing on a prescription
of you. Hey everybody, hope you all enjoyed that conversation with Ryan Cabrera. The song you were just hearing is Prescription of You. It's Ryan's new single, so go check that out. And don't go anywhere, we got lots more Krista Makes a Podcast coming right up after a few words from our sponsors.
Mm-hmm. I don't think it overstates things to say that the Beatles were the greatest gift to entertainment and culture of our time, a secular religion, if you will, with their universal appeal and demonstrable impact on people's lives. I'm Robert Rodriguez, host of Something About the Beatles. With every episode, I speak with historians, musicians, artists, and Beatle witnesses, all in the service of fresh insights into the most joyous cultural entity the world has ever known. I hope you'll join me and listen to Something About the Beatles, now on Evergreen and wherever you get your podcasts.
One Hit Thunder is a podcast where we celebrate and occasionally have a laugh about those bands and artists that had one song that most people remember. Although many musicians may reject the term one-hit wonder, we beg to differ with their aversion to it, because wouldn't we all love to have a beloved hit song? On One Hit Thunder, we're joined by interesting guests from the world of music and comedy to dive into one artist each week. Our back catalog runs deep with episodes about everyone from Wild Cherry to Snow to Tag Team to Harvey Danger, and a new episode comes out every Wednesday. Subscribe to One Hit Thunder wherever you get your podcasts and join in on the fun.
As we near the end of the show, here's a band you might not know.
Welcome to this week's Band You Might Not Know. If you'd like your band to be considered for Krista Makes a Podcast, email your best song via MP3 only and a short bio to bandyoumightnotknow@gmail.com. This week's featured artist is Two Birds, a rock-pop duo from Nashville, Tennessee, consisting of AJ and Lenny, who together are pushing the boundaries of what a pop rock band should sound like. You can find their music on Spotify. Here's a snippet of their song, Pop Rocks.
Whatever it is, keep giving it up, so good, babe. I just want you now and later. You know you're my favorite flavor, your Pop Rocks.
The Wrap with Chris and Chris.
So Chris, yet again, another great episode. I think it was a really cool story to hear about a young artist being thrown into the fire. And I'm sure that you and I can kind of relate to certain aspects of that story as well. We've all been young and part of the music industry in one way or another. But I thought his was especially interesting because there were a few things in his story where I know he was even saying, like, what was I thinking? Especially when it came to like the Johnny Resnick stuff, where he was like, I just kind of forgot that he was the guy from the Goo Goo Dolls who wrote all these great songs. It felt like we were on a level playing field there. And he's talking about having some arguments and stuff. It sounds like he called it naivete, basically. But looking back, he's like, whoa, what'd I do? But it's a good thing that everything happened the way it did, because he got a hit album out of it.
Yeah, pretty no, cool. It's a crazy story. And you know what? I was going to ask him. I didn't even get into this because we'd probably still be talking to him right now, because it could have went on. But I was like, well, like, what did his parents and his family think of this? You know, he's like 20, 21 years old. Like, hey, kid, you're coming to L.A. with me. It's like, how many times have you heard that before? And, you know, there's tons of good looking kids, singers, songwriters, right now, back then, every day, that just have this dream of doing what Ryan has done that never even got to LA. Okay. And here he is in LA. And maybe that was part of his, you know, maybe it was a little bit of being young, naive, whatever, but cockiness. He's in there going, hey, he's had a number of people kind of blow smoke at him. So it's like, well, John Resnick's just the next character in line.
Well, I mean, part of his story too, going in front of label executives with an acoustic guitar and just sitting down and playing. Yeah. If someone asked you to do that right now, wouldn't you have a lot of nerves about that? Like going into the president of a record company and just playing and singing?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I had mentioned to him too, that his recall of that time period, because I know it's like anything else. It's like the first time you go to Disney, what do you remember about it? It was overwhelming, right? You know, you're a young kid and all these, you know, but by the fifth or sixth time you go, like you can recount specific things. Oh, when they do this and they get ready for this, that's what they do. You know, think of all the firsts that he was experiencing during this time.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought it was really cool too, hearing the story about, who do you want to produce your album? Oh, I don't know, Johnny Resnick, and thinking he's just throwing out, you know, shooting for the moon as far as producers go. Johnny Resnick wasn't even a producer.
Right.
And this was the first thing he ever produced. And then it worked out. I mean, to me, that's inspiring for like, hey, go for it. Who knows? The worst that someone can say is no, right?
Yeah. And you know what? Maybe Johnny Resnick didn't like the experience. Nothing against Ryan, not personal, because you have a hit record like this. You'd think that his, mm-hmm. you know, people be knocking down Johnny's door wanting him to produce. Maybe he was too busy with Goo Goo Dolls, but I think he could have parlayed this into some serious cash. You could have gotten at least another couple records, even if they stiffed. So I found that kind of interesting that Johnny's never really done anything else production-wise.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you have to be a certain type of person to want to be a producer. Maybe yeah. Johnny Resnick just wants to be the artist and be produced by someone else. You know, it's not for everybody, but he tried it out and it definitely worked in the time yeah. he did it. You know, this was a hit song. And I also thought that it was cool that he talked about how Johnny was like, yeah, come on over. And they were listening to some music and then they instantly start writing music together. They already wrote songs the first time they hung out. That goes a long way, right? I would think if I sat down and instantly started writing songs with somebody the first time we hung out, that would lead to a good working relationship.
Yeah, and that whole tuning thing, you know, the older I get, I'll mess with it sometimes. I've done, you know, the Keith Richards open G tuning, and when you don't play like that and you go to put your fingers on the fretboard, you're like, wait a second, I got to figure this out a little differently. It makes you relearn the instrument almost, and immediately when I start doing alternate tunings, I'll come up with something. It might be a riff, it might be an idea for a song, but something comes out of it.
That's interesting. I was going to ask you if you ever played around with alternate tunings. I, minus drop D or playing half a step down, I've never played around with that. I wouldn't even, mm-hmm. it's never even crossed my mind as something to try, but I'm kind of a little bit inspired to look up, hey, what are some alternate tunings just to see, like you said, would something happen from that?
Well,
that
I don't sound like me when I'm playing it. Okay, I already know what I'm going to do on a standard tuned guitar. So it automatically makes it's a different texture. It's a different vibe. Yeah, it's still me playing it, but it doesn't sound like, you know, something I would typically play. It opens up your mind a little bit differently. So I'm glad that that Johnny shared that with him and kind of shook things up a little bit. I thought it was interesting. They go a half beat, faster, a half BPM faster in the choruses. I don't know if I've heard half. I've heard go up a beat or something, but that was interesting.
That's so negligible. That's so crazy that that's such a slight amount. I've heard about the going up 2 BPM in the chorus, because even 2 BPM, you don't really hear it.
Yeah.
You know, the average listener is not going to hear that really. So yeah, that's interesting. I also thought the story about Sabelle having the tape recorder and just sort of taping the conversations as inspiration for lyrics. I don't think I've ever heard that before. I know that you can take inspiration from wherever, but I've never heard of someone like breaking out a tape recorder for the conversation, not for like we're jamming, mm-hmm. for conversation. And I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, I hadn't heard of the tape recorder like that. I've definitely heard of producers pulling out a notepad and say, tell me about your relationship, what went south, and they'll take down some notes and jot kind of when the artist is, or, you know, is giving them stream of consciousness. But yeah, I thought that was interesting too.
Yeah, and you and I are always recording our conversations, Chris.
We certainly are. So you should go over to KristaMakes.com. It's our version of Patreon. It's our supporting cast. KristaMakes.com. You'll get bonus episodes each week of the After Party. That's right. Chris and I will gladly talk to you after the main Monday show is off. ChrisDemakes.com. Also, if you could, go over and subscribe to the Chris DeMakes official YouTube channel. Chris Fafalius has been putting up tons of cool clips over there, so go check it out and give Chris a follow on Instagram at Chris Fafalius, and give me a follow on Instagram at Less Than Chris D. Want to thank our guest this week, Ryan Cabrera, for sitting with us, and we'll see you next week.
Hey, Chris Makes a Podcast producer, Chris Fafalius here. You may have heard me talk about my band Punchline before. Maybe you already know us, or maybe you're hearing about us for the first time right now. It doesn't matter. No matter what your relationship with Punchline is, I will absolutely guarantee that you'll love our new podcast, A Band Called Punchline. Starting with our humble beginnings in a small town in southwestern Pennsylvania in 1997, we're telling the hilarious, strange, and hopefully inspiring story of the 25 plus years of our band in the most honest way possible, podcast style. A Band Called Punchline is an audio documentary available now wherever you get your pods. So subscribe and let me and my friends share a wild, entertaining, unique, and wonderful tale of music and perseverance unlike any other that's still being written today.
Ready for a head-bangingly good time? Dive into the world of heavy metal with the Brutally Delicious podcast. Here, we don't just talk music. We welcome you into our heavy metal family. Join us for candid chats with legends and rising stars. We go beyond the typical interviews, exploring raw emotions and the life-altering impact of heavy metal. So whether you're a diehard metalhead or just curious, join our family and let the headbanging begin with the Brutally Delicious podcast.
Hey there, I am Johnny Christ from Avenged Sevenfold, and I've got a podcast called Drinks with Johnny you're going to want to check out. I sit down with a bunch of different people from all different walks of life, from professional wrestlers to actors, comedians, fighters, musicians, everything in between. I'm just looking to make some friends and have a good time doing it. So if that sounds like something you're into, go check out Drinks with Johnny, streaming everywhere now.